From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host and producer, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 136, The Lighthouses of Cape Disappointment. The mighty Columbia River begins as just a tiny stream at the base of the Canadian Rockies and wanders over 1,200 miles, combining with several rivers and streams until it eventually reaches the Pacific Ocean. The Columbia's force as it flows into the sea forms one of the world's most dangerous bars, as proven by the 234-plus ships that have either been left stranded, sunk, or burned near the river's mouth between the years of 1725 and 1961. The first American to safely cross the bar was American Robert Gray on the 11th of May, 1792. Gray was a seafarer more interested in finding furs for the Chinese market than the honor of discovery, and the river was named after his ship, the Columbia Rediviva. The entry to the river is marked by a prominent cape on the north side of the river's mouth. Captain John Mears gave the cape its current name after it had already been named Caisi by the local Indians and then Cape San Rogue by Bruno de Heceta in 1775. Disappointment continued to accompany us. We can fairly say that no river San Rogue exists, Mears wrote on the 6th of July, 1788, after futilely trying to find shelter from a raging sea. Mears dubbed the cape Cape Disappointment out of sheer frustration. The place was initially documented by Spanish explorer Bruno Heceta in 1775, who dubbed it Bahia de la Asunción, or Bay of the Assumption. Then in 1792, Robert Gray ended up giving the cape the name Cape Hancock, but after learning that Mears had named it earlier, he altered it to Disappointment, and the name has stuck ever since, with the state park being renamed from Fort Canby State Park to Cape Disappointment to honor the 200th anniversary of the Lewis and Clark expedition in 2005. Though many old-timers around the area still refer to the park as Fort Canby State Park. Until three conspicuous spruce trees growing on the cape's peak were topped to mark the point, a white flag hoisted on top of the cape was used to indicate the river's perilous entrance. From 5 miles offshore, a ship would line the three trees, then go for the cape's southerly tip to navigate through the river's deepest part. In 1848, a lighthouse was planned for the cape and marked it as one of the first along the west coast, and a contract for its construction was signed on the 30th of April, 1852. The contract originally set aside $31,000 for Cape Disappointment, however, this cost was increased by $7,500 due to some design changes that were soon required. The considerably rising commerce of Oregon demands that these improvements be implemented soon, wrote William P. MacArthur of the United States Coast Survey in advocating a lighthouse on Cape Disappointment and five buoys to designate the channel. More vessels have crossed the Columbia River bar in the last 18 months than maybe at any other time in history, and only a few vessels have been injured in the process. Nevertheless, only a few have experienced significant delays. The contractors Gibbons and Kelly of Baltimore, Maryland, dispatched the Oriole to Cape Disappointment after starting construction on four lighthouses down in California. The Oriole attempted to cross the Columbia River bar on the 18th of September 1853 after waiting 8 days offshore for circumstances to improve. It would quickly meet its demise at the foot of Cape Disappointment. The 32-man crew narrowly averted death, but the vessel and all construction materials on board the ship were lost. 2 years later, construction finally began, but was again delayed when it was determined that the tower's upper diameter was insufficient to house the lantern room for the 4-ton first-order Fresnel lens built in Paris by Louis Sauter and Company. Due to this, the tower had to be entirely demolished and rebuilt brick by brick, which must have been quite the painstaking and frustrating task for the men given the job. The Cape Disappointment Lighthouse, upon its completion in the fall of 1856, was the 9th operating light on the West Coast when it was originally lit on the 15th of October of that year. 6 of the original 8 lighthouses were built with a circular tower protruding from the center of a keeper's dwelling, but there was only enough room for a circular tower at Cape Disappointment, so a detached dwelling had to be built a considerable distance away. The brick tower at Cape Disappointment is 53 feet tall, with a focal plane of 220 feet above the sea and a diameter that tapers from 14 feet 4 inches at the base to 10 feet 6 inches at the lantern room. The station was also given a 1,600-pound fog bell, but due to the volume of the surf and the distance at which seafarers needed to hear it, it was determined to be of little to no use. John Boyd, a man who underwent more than his fair share of trials at Cape Disappointment before dying on duty on the 26th of October, 1865, was the lighthouse's first keeper. As the winter approaches, we find it exceedingly damp, cold, and uncomfortable watching the light without a fire in the tower, Boyd wrote to Hartman Bash, his boss in San Francisco. As the keepers found standing watch in the tower disagreeable at best in the cool October weather, because the residence was so far from the tower, individuals in charge of the watch are forced to sleep there. We are in desperate need of a little stove and would suffer through the long chilly evenings if we do not have one. It would be preferable if we could use it to heat oil and water. During the Civil War, fortifications were built on Cape Disappointment to guard the Columbia River's mouth. The impact from a 15-inch gun discharged in 1865 damaged 11 panes of glass in the lantern room of the tower. Keeper Boyd recommended that the lighthouse be moved, but instead received the following advice. All windows in the lighthouse structures to be opened and all steps taken if possible to avoid injury to the lens, lamp, and other items of machinery connected with the lighthouse. The dwelling, which was positioned down the hill from the lighthouse, was one of the main annoyances. Keeper Boyle wrote to his superior about the keeper's quarters in 1858, stating frustratingly, "I wish to make a request with regards to our dwelling. There is about a foot of water in the cellar, making the house, as you doubtless already know, very damp and uncomfortable, and it is not only disagreeable, but unhealthy during the winter. I have made no complaint before, but have borne the inconveniences year after year, hoping that something would be done to make our dwelling more comfortable, and supposed that the cellar would have been cemented last summer. What we ask is that you will fill up the cellar about 3.5 feet, that being as high as the water rises since the ditch was made. Thus we would still have room to keep our vegetables from frost in the winter." To make matters worse, Keeper Boyd and his assistants went 5 quarters without receiving their pay and were forced to live on credit. As a result of this, the helpers became pretty irresponsible and just generally very sloppy at their work duties. The helpers were not always cooperative, even when they were paid on time. "I loathe making complaints about aides, but I trust you will not blame me under the circumstances," Keeper Boyd wrote in May of 1865. Boyd continued by writing, "Mr. Wheeler, a carpenter, has arrived to begin work on the addition to the house, and he has requested that the assistants dig the post holes and construct the foundation. C. Flores showed up for work, but Henry Brown refused firmly. I told him to carry up the lumber that had been landed the day before, but he stated rudely that it wasn't his job. This was not his first refusal of duty, and he has been extremely discourteous since his arrival. He claims he is prepared to depart at any time." Boyd didn't get to appreciate the new addition for long because he passed away that October of the same year. Second assistant keeper Harrington was crossing the river to Astoria in the station's boat on the 25th of October, 1858, when it tragically capsized. The assistant was observed climbing onto the bottom of the upset boat by a man on the distant coast, who quickly went on to dispatch 3 Native Americans in a sturdy canoe to rescue him. However, the boat had drifted into the breakers before they could reach him, and Harrington was never seen again, becoming yet another of the many that have lost their lives to the dangerous waters that make up the graveyard of the Pacific. From 1865 to 1877, Captain J.W. Joel Munson was in charge of the Cape Disappointment Light Station. The bark Industry was wrecked near the Cape on the 15th of March, 1865, and only 7 of the 24 passengers aboard survived. Joel Munson was deeply concerned that more people could have been saved if the guardians of the Cape had access to a life-saving craft. Munson then chose to reconstruct a dilapidated longboat found on the shore for use as a lifeguard vessel. Munson, a skilled fiddler, organized 2 dances in Astoria, charging $2.50 a person, to generate more than $200 for the boat's restoration. Munson fitted the boat with cork-filled tenders with the help of an old sailor, and the keepers built a boathouse for it near the station. The W.B. Scranton, carrying 800 tons of freight from San Francisco, was driven into the central sands of the bar on the 5th of May, 1866. Keeper Munson and a few other men launched their vessel and were able to successfully save the entire crew. Captain Paul Corno of the Scranton was, ironically, one of the 7 survivors of the wreck of the Industry. Munson's efforts resulted in the establishment of a life-saving station at Cape Disappointment in 1871, and his famed rescue boat was included in the station's inaugural equipment. The Coast Guard Lifeboat Station and Training School on the Cape continues the legacy of saving lives to this day. Also in 1871, a new double housing for the keepers at Cape Disappointment was built. The duplex had 11 rooms on either side. One side was occupied by the chief keeper, while the other was shared by the two assistants. A new bell house was also needed that year, after the old one was smashed by cannon fire from a nearby battery. The fog bell at the station was retired in 1881 and moved to the West Point Lighthouse on Puget Sound, where it remains today, sadly without any historical marker or plaque to let folks know where the random bell originally came from. Maybe someday that will happen, but I doubt it. Before being elevated to head keeper at Willapa Bay Lighthouse, James Anderson worked as a first assistant keeper at Cape Disappointment for several years. Anderson returned to Cape Disappointment in 1877 after 4 years away to take over as chief keeper for Munson. Anderson would have periods of immense happiness and extreme grief over his 17 years at the station, as demonstrated by the following notes in the station's logbook. August 4th, 1881, marriage at Lightkeeper's Dwelling House. James Anderson to Henrietta Sorensen, light breeze from southwest, very warm. December 15, 1883, a more beautiful sunset could never have been witnessed as last night, so brilliant clouds in the horizon all around for a great distance with all imaginable colors of all kinds as ever the eye could behold until about 20 minutes after the setting of the sun, when all changed. Changed lighthouse lamp and burner. December 17, 1883, born at Lightkeeper's Dwelling at 3 a.m. to the wife of James Anderson, a daughter. October 13, 1884, young daughter of James Anderson and Henrietta Anderson died at 4 a.m. this morning at Fort Canby, aged 9 months, 26 days. Peace be with her soul. July 26, 1885. Died at Keeper's Dwelling House, infant child of James Anderson at 4 o'clock p.m. Henrietta Marie Anderson, aged 5 months and 15 days. The first order lens was transported to the newly built North Head Lighthouse in 1898 and replaced with a fourth order Barber and Bernard Fresnel lens made in 1896. The smaller lens rotated to create alternate red and white flashes spaced by 15 seconds and contained 6 flash panels, 3 of which were fitted with ruby shields. The first order lens is presently on exhibit at Cape Disappointment State Park's Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center. The characteristic black horizontal band on Cape Disappointment was added in 1930 to distinguish it from North Head Lighthouse, which is only 2 miles to the north. But I'll get into the history of that particular lighthouse in just a little bit. In 1936, a Class C radio beacon was installed at Cape Disappointment, and the light was powered the following year. The Coast Guard wanted to turn off the light in 1965, stating that the Columbia River lightship and entry range lights were enough to designate the river, but the Columbia River bar pilots protested, and the light was maintained. The light was automated beginning in 1973, but the patriarch of Northwest Lighthouses, with its fourth order lens remaining in place, is still operational to this day. The Cape Disappointment Lighthouse may be seen to the southeast and North Head Lighthouse to the north from the main campground at Cape Disappointment State Park. What exactly happened to bring two lighthouses so close together anyways? Mariners entering the Columbia River from the north complained that they couldn't see the light until they were almost there after the Cape Disappointment Light Station was built in 1856 to mark the river's entry. The many shipwrecks that happened around the Long Beach Peninsula, which is just north of the Cape, fueled their need for a new lighthouse. The Lighthouse Board expressed their support for a new lighthouse in North Head in 1889, writing, "For the sake of commerce and navigation, the current light at Cape Disappointment is insufficient. If a first-order light is installed at North Head and the anticipated light stations at Grace Harbor and Destruction Island are built, the Pacific coast will be well lit from Cape Flattery down to Tillamook Rock. At North Head, proper precautions should be made to establish a first-order light. It is expected that this will cost $50,000. The first-order light at Cape Disappointment will no longer be required after this light is installed, and it is proposed that it be reduced to a fourth-order light. It will then have enough power to benefit vessels outside the bar and those in the Columbia. Congress authorized the construction of a lighthouse on North Head for a cost of not more than $50,000 on the 15th of April, 1893, and it supplied the first $25,000 on the 18th of August, 1894, and the second allotment of $25,000 on the 2nd of March, 1895. On the 15th of July, 1895, bids for building a wagon road from the target grounds at adjacent Fort Canby to the construction site were opened, but because the lowest price far exceeded the estimate, the road was built by hired labor with supplies obtained on the open market. In September of 1896, separate contracts were granted for the metalwork on the tower and the construction of the station building. The metalwork was supposed to arrive at Fort Canby's port on the 23rd of April, 1897, but it didn't actually arrive until the 15th of August, a full 173 days late. The contractor was penalized $4,325 for the delay, which was $160 more than the total value of the contract. By the spring of 1897, George Langford, the station's contractor, had finished the residence's barn and as much of the tower and two oil houses as possible without the metalwork. Langford completed his work on the 15th of November, 1897, after the metalwork arrived. North Head Lighthouse was designed by Carl W. Leick and is made of brick masonry with a sandstone foundation and a cement plaster overlay. The lantern room, which is 65 feet from the ground and 194 feet above sea level, is reached via 69 stairs. On the 16th of May, 1898, the first order Fresnel lens, which was transferred from Cape Disappointment light, was illuminated for the first time in that tower. The two lights needed separate characteristics because North Head is only 2 miles north of Cape Disappointment. North Head was given a fixed white appearance, while Cape Disappointment had alternating red and white flashes. Alexander K. Pessinen, the top keeper of Tillamook Rock Lighthouse, was assigned to North Head as the lighthouse's first keeper. Keeper Pessinen moved to the U.S. in 1876 after being born in Finland in 1859. In 1919, Pessinen received the Lighthouse Efficiency Flag for operating the district's model station. Pessinen married Mary Watson in 1890. 2 years after landing at North Head, after being released from the seclusion of Tillamook Rock, Keeper Pessinen brought his wife to a doctor in Portland, Oregon in the spring of 1923, and she was diagnosed with melancholia, a malady characterized by persistent depression and irrational phobias. On the 8th of June, the couple returned to North Head, and Mary got up early the next morning to go for a stroll with her dog, Jerry. The dog reappeared a short time later, and Keeper Pessinen was alerted to the fact that something was awry by the dog's strange behavior. According to the local paper, he alerted the boys at the radio station as well as at the weather office, and a search party was quickly prepared. The dog led searchers to a site near the North Head Lighthouse, very near the ruins of the fire control station seen there today, where they discovered her coat on the cliff's edge. A trail through the long grass, as if someone had slid down the cliff, was all that remained of the unlucky woman's fate. Second assistant keeper Frank C. Hammond risked his life to collect Mary's body from the cliff's base before the tide could transport it out to sea. Mary Pessinen was buried in Owako, and Alexander was buried close to his wife when he died 2 years later, not long after retiring. Mary had joined the Unity organization, which was known for faith-based healings, a few years before her death, and the night before she died, she penned a letter to God in which she stated, "I recognize where I have been wrong in a great many ways, but please God, I will try to change and do better. I'm even going to try to go without my medicine and just hope that things improve." Mabel Bretherton, the lighthouse's only female keeper, was transferred to North Head from Cape Blanco in 1905, where she remained as a second assistant keeper. Bernard J. Bretherton, who worked as an assistant at Coquille River Lighthouse until his death from tuberculosis in February of 1903, was Mabel's husband. The lighthouse service frequently hired widows of keepers to assist in maintaining their family, and this was most certainly the case with Mabel, who had 3 children under the age of 10 in 1903. Mabel left the lighthouse in 1907 and went to work as the superintendent of a women's exchange in Portland by 1910. Keepers at North Head had to rescue people who got too close to the cliffs on at least 2 early occasions. First assistant keeper Claiborne R. Williams saved a man who was hanging from a cliff south of the station and was about to fall 75 feet to the sea below on the 7th of September 1931. Keeper Andros G. Siniloto rescued a man 3 years later who had survived a 100-foot fall to the rocks below. North Head is one of the windiest sites in the United States, with wind gusts above 100 miles per hour being recorded on a regular basis. In 1902, the United States Weather Bureau established a station on North Head between the lighthouse and the keeper's quarters. Winds of 126 miles per hour were recorded there on the 29th of January 1921, before the measuring instrument was blown away. Fearing for their safety, the weather observers sought shelter in the keepers' quarters, which were more soundly constructed. The meteorological station was decommissioned in 1955, and most of the structures were removed afterwards. During the first half of the 20th century, the U.S. Army operated a signal station at North Head to convey meteorological observations to passing warships, as well as the artillery at Fort Canby. The personnel's quarters were north of the keeper's quarters, and the operations building was between the keeper's quarters and the weather station. The ruins of a tennis court created by the signal corps can be seen on the cement area immediately west of the head keeper's house. A wild duck crashed through one of the lantern room's storm glass on the 19th of April 1932, damaging the lens somewhat and probably scaring the crap out of whoever was inside the lighthouse at the time of the incident. At other stations, wire nets had been installed around lantern rooms to avoid such accidents, but incidences of this nature were quite unusual in the area. In 1937, 2 years after the station received electricity, a fourth order lens replaced the original first order one. The keeper was forced to turn out the light 5 years later on the 22nd of June 1942 at 12:35 a.m. After a Japanese submarine fired on Fort Stevens, Oregon, the nearby lighthouses were dimmed as part of a strategy to keep the location of Fort Stevens and Fort Canby disguised until the danger passed. This incident is another story that I have long considered making an episode about, but it's mainly centered in Oregon. If you're interested in hearing about that anyways, reach out and let me know and I might make an episode about it in the near future. The fourth order lens was replaced in 1950 by two spinning aero beacons. When photoelectric cells were fitted to turn the light on and off in 1961, the light was automated and the final keeper left on the 1st of July 1961. The lighthouse began to degrade when the keepers left. Fortunately, the lighthouse was refurbished by the Coast Guard in 1984, allowing Cape Disappointment State Park to open the tower to the public. The keeper's cottages, approximately a quarter mile into the woods from the tower, have also been renovated, and both the duplex and single-family buildings have been available for overnight visits since 2000. The housing had previously been used for park rangers. Two of the North Head Lighthouse's Fresnel lens have been saved. The first order lens, which was on exhibit outside the lighthouse in 1951, is now on display at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center in Cape Disappointment State Park, while the fourth order lens is on show at the Columbia River Maritime Museum across the river in Astoria. The two aero beacons were kept in the lantern room until the 28th of September 1992, when a contemporary beacon was installed on the lantern room's top railing. In December of 1996, a Vega rotating beacon was put inside the lantern chamber, lit by a 12-volt bulb on a 6-bulb appliance that rotates in a fresh bulb when one burns out. The transfer of North Head Lighthouse to the Washington State Parks and Recreation Commission was approved by Congress in 1983, but the area around the tower was known to be contaminated due to the use of lead-based paint. And CERCLA requires that any federal agency transferring real property out of federal ownership must certify that all remedial action necessary to protect human health and the environment has been taken. The handover was postponed because cleaning up the land was not a top priority for the Coast Guard. Under a contract with the Coast Guard, White Shield Inc. began cleaning up the contaminated soil around the lighthouse beginning on the 17th of October 2011. The lighthouse's title was eventually transferred to Washington State Parks in October of 2012, and the keepers of North Head Lighthouse quickly began part of the lighthouse's roughly $2 million in renovations. The keepers of North Head Lighthouse have raised some money through tours and retail sales, and they successfully applied to and received Lighthouse Environmental Programs funding, which are raised from the selling of lighthouse license plates in the Evergreen State. In 2015, the lantern chamber was restored, and starting in 2016, the tower received much-needed attention. North Head is the Pacific Northwest's most complete lighthouse station. The tower, two oil houses, two residences, a barn, chicken coop, and garages are among the original structures still surviving, and you can check them out today. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review, and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include Umbrella Guide to Washington Lighthouses by Charlene and Ted Nelson, Lighthouses of the Pacific by Jim Gibbs, Annual Reports of the Lighthouse Board, The Chinook Observer, the Columbia Pacific Heritage Museum, the Pacific County Historical Society, HistoryLink.org, and the Columbia River Maritime Museum in Astoria, Oregon. Thank you for listening to episode 136, The Lighthouses of Cape Disappointment. Episode 137 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Alan Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next week, I'm your host and producer, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the whole. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck. And Moklips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.